welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by Dr. Adam Francisco to discuss J.R.R. Tolkien today. The last month or so, we have been spending time talking about sort of these great literary theologians of the 20th century, starting with C.S. Lewis in particular. We did an overview of Lewis' life inspired by the docudrama The Most Reluctant Convert, which is also, it was like a one-day, two-day special movie appearance, but is also a screenplay, right?
Yep.
As well, I haven't seen it as a play. I actually talked to somebody about the movie, and they're like, I think I've seen that play. And I'm like, yeah, that would be kind of cool. And then...
Can I butt in for a second? Have you heard anything? I thought you said last time we talked that you're going to check into
whether
if
it's
this
streaming.
Was going to be streamed. Or...
Oh, yeah, no, I didn't do a good job of checking. Okay. I Googled it, and I just saw the play, more information about the play. Okay. They've got to be streaming it, right?
No. Yeah, there's got to be some pirated.
Some pirated C.S. Lewis movie. That'd be great. As he ends with, there are no ordinary people.
Just pirates and...
Just pirates and immortals.
Yeah. I guess I'll still have to... It looks like if my internet would work, that Amazon might have it for purchase.
Oh. That is a book.
No, that is a book. So yeah. I don't... I'll have to... When I was searching it, it was just more about the play that I came across. I also came across... I don't know how you found it, Adam, because, I mean, you were the one who told us about the movie, but apparently they went around not just advertising but interviewing people on every evangelical Christian podcast in America, and I just don't listen to enough of any of those to know that it was about. So how did you hear about it, Adam? It just circulated at the college?
No. Nobody was aware of it at the college. I think it was on a podcast is where I heard about it.
Which one?
Yes. I think it was the Alistair McGrath one.
Oh,
but I heard listened to one just the other day with Michael Ward,
yes.
C.S. Lewis scholar, and he was saying that he even plays a role in the film. He's the priest.
Oh,
Headington Quarry or something like that.
Oh, that's interesting for sure.
Interesting.
So, so we started with Lewis like that, and then we tried to not just give an overview of his works, but you know, we talked about the scope and impact of his works, the particular Christian nature of them, and then did some recommendation based off of that. We then did an episode on the Inkling. So if you want to catch up, if you're interested in any of that, all of that was leading up to today. And from the Inklings, we decided we would do one on Tolkien. This is actually maybe outside of some of the doctrinal topics we're asked to do regularly or to revisit regularly. This is maybe the most requested individual topic for us to do that we haven't done on the show.
Tolkien?
An episode on Tolkien.
Interesting.
Is it because we've done so much Lewis?
I think it's because we've done so much Lewis. And my response to people is that...
Lewis is easier.
Lewis is easier
yes,
because
he
was a public theologian. And the show being, you know, even when it's historical, sort of commentary from a systematic theological perspective and a Lutheran theological perspective, it's easier to make theological commentary and conversation about Lewis than it is with Tolkien. But that's part of, I think, what we will get into today. You know, as a brief introduction, I think I would have a hard time imagining somebody listening to this show and not recognizing the name J.R.R. Tolkien. The world he created, the fantasy world he created with The Lord of the Rings and now its legacy in the movies and all spin-offs with what's going to be a new TV show coming out through Amazon that I'm sure a lot of people are aware of, video games, board games, you name it, right? People are aware of this even if they haven't read his books. And I think that's probably the case, right, is that most people have not finished his saga. They've probably encountered it through the movies and other popular media.
Yeah. Those movies, what do you all think about those movies?
I have fond memories of them. So that's the, you know, that's
I've never,
name.
I said this at in my talk at the Heroes Will Stand Las Vegas is that things like that are helpful to me because I don't have a vivid imagination. So when I read, say, like, you know, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, I'm not really painting pictures when I'm reading and processing the words. And of course I can like imagine a village or whatever and imagine a battle. And, but things like movies help me because the people who make movies usually have a much more creative imagination than me and can sort of create the pictures. And I very often will go, oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's better than what my very formal mind was putting together for a dragon.
I have the same issue, or at least lately I have. I remember when I was younger reading a fiction, I would envision it in my head, but lately for probably over a decade now, it's really hard for me to imagine things. I don't read fiction. In fact, very rarely do I read fiction. I was going to say it. I don't read fiction all that often. But you remember when we talked with, I think it was Jim Nesigan, when he talked about how we typically read like conquering armies or something like that?
Conquering
an army, yeah. Is it because you're reading just to get through the book so you can put it on your shelf so you say you've read it? Because I think that's what's going on with me.
Oh, yeah.
I'll read stuff just so I can say I've read it, because I feel like everybody else has read it. I've got to read it. But I don't I don't have this stuff going on in my head when I'm reading it.
I don't know. Maybe. I don't recall that with the Tolkien stuff. I just think that I just process things more formally than creatively. And, you know, I memorize... I can very easily memorize concepts and ideas and even sort of full sentences and paragraphs that I've read, but I can't as easily make a mental picture that I could describe to a painter, you know, to make that. And so movies help me with that kind of thing. So as far as your original question, what did I think of the movies? I like them. I mean, there's obvious creative license taken beyond things that he put in the book and love interest created and even known characters put places where they're not in the books. But, you know, making movies is not the same thing as writing a novel.
One thing's for sure, you did not like the bio or the biography of Tolkien. I think it was just called Tolkien, wasn't it?
Yeah, I didn't like it, even though I actually liked that actor. I don't know his name, but he played Beast in the X-Men stuff. I actually liked that actor. Okay. No, I didn't. The thing I didn't like about it is it wasn't really Tolkien's life story as much as it was sort of a love story about him falling in love with his wife. But it didn't even really get into the very important aspects of his life that I thought it was going to, including his, I didn't even think it went that deep into his work at Oxford or becoming an Oxford Don, let alone his fact that he was a very, very, very committed Roman Catholic.
Yeah. Yeah. There's his whole life. Glimpses of that.
Yeah. I think from the movie you can get that he was, but
if you already know it,
but that's different than portraying his life accurately where his life was dedicated to his faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I've seen audiences argue about how important that is when you read Tolkien's world, mostly because of, I don't think something he would have anticipated, but people's adoption of that world he created for their own personalities, right? There's a trend, you know, when it comes to fiction, where your personality, your character traits are made up by living your life always as an analogy, your favorite fiction. So that might be Lord of the Rings, that might be Star Wars, that might be the Marvel Universe or something else, right? But that a lot of those people, I would say, contend that his Catholicism is not important.
Oh, my Lord.
Right? Because I actually think it's secular people looking for meaning who find their personalities in fiction.
That's interesting. I mean, if you read any biographical material on J.R.R. Tolkien, his life revolved around the practice of his faith and his family and then his work as an Oxford Don, and then his work as an author.
So let's,
but like, in that order, I would say.
Yeah, so let's talk about his life a little bit here, just to give people an overview of not only that lifelong Catholicism, but sort of just a development of his life. So at a very, very young age, as a toddler, he and his family moved to South Africa.
Yeah.
Which was, I guess, at the time, he was born in the 1890s, 1892, 1894?
Yeah.
Okay, 1892. That's right. That, at the time is not unusual. Adam, what do you know about that? From what I've gathered and read, his father moved there for financial opportunity. Mm-hmm.
I don't know all the details, but I thought it had something to do with agriculture, and it went south pretty quickly. Somebody got real sick, right?
Well, so his dad died in Africa, but they had already moved. His brother and his mom had already moved back to England. Is what I know. I know that I don't remember the exact business opportunity that his father moved the family to Africa for, but there was a financial opportunity. Their mother ended up having sort of objections to what the upbringing of the sons and their education would look like, schooling system and available in South Africa. And so she moved with the boys back to England to start schooling with them. And I think within a year or 18 months, his father fell ill and died. And so that is sort of the backdrop of his young childhood is, you know, for the most part, he doesn't have his father. Mm-hmm. His father dies, I think, when Tolkien's 5 or 6.
Well, his mother dies too. That's why he ends up living with that that priest.
Right.
Or the priest is his guardian, at least, yeah, and living with him.
So you know how I'm prone to remember obscure things, but I don't remember the important stuff?
Yeah.
I just looked it up to verify, but I guess Tolkien also, when he was very young, was bitten by what's called a baboon spider, like a large, it's not like a tarantula, but some large spider, but apparently some people say that you know, that scene in, or that, you know, those spiders.
Oh,
in
yeah.
Inspired by... Man-eating spiders inspired.
He had
by
arachnophobia.
Spider.
Yeah, he had arachnophobia his whole life.
Maybe.
Oh, wouldn't you though? Jiminy's.
Yeah, I don't know what a baboon spider is, but it doesn't sound pleasant.
It doesn't. Sounds ridiculous.
So he has what is sort of a tragic upbringing in a sense, right? Parental loss very young, followed by another parental loss in his teenage years, and then sort of following that. The backdrop of the world at war for the first time and the horrors of World War One. So he was at the Battle of the Somme in World War One.
That's no small thing. That's an awful thing.
That's an awful thing. Yeah.
I don't know how many tens of thousands of people died in just a few short days, but it was people dropping dead left and right. Being cut in half by machine guns.
To the point where, you know, 60, 70 years later, there's still whole sections of that area that are cordoned off because of possibility of unexploded munitions in the area. I mean, it's just a type of horrendous experience that I don't think we can even imagine.
I know we can't imagine it because I don't think it would be controversial to say that the last 2 years have universally demonstrated that we are a society at the moment that practically does not know what death looks like, right? That the onset of a disease that brings significant loss and significant death, but minute compared to this great tragedy of the early 1900s and a second great war following it, has brought things to a standstill, right? Brought people to the grips and reality of facing death on a daily level for the first time in a long time. That world just 100 years ago was very intimate with death, destruction, and the depravity of humanity.
Yeah. I mean, it's just something that's outside of our reach of understanding. And he was there. I mean, so think of how this, as he's writing battle scenes and the horror of battle and all that, how actually experiencing something like the Battle of the Somme influences your writing in that regard. I would think it would influence it greatly.
Right. So I think outside of that backdrop, the important highlight or starting highlight for me is something that we touched on last episode, which is that as far as the way that his theology interacts with his work, he is not doing public lay theology in the same way that Lewis did, but that instead he sort of has a philosophy and a theology of fiction or literature or myth that comes into his writings, influences the reason why he's writing, what he's writing about, how his writing terminates, the way stories end and develop. And so that's, if we're going to talk about him from a theological perspective, it's going to be about this theology of myth that he presents us, right? And Dad, you know quite a bit about this.
Yeah, I mean, he gave a famous lecture called On Fairy Stories that people often refer to it as a book. It wasn't a book. It was a lecture that he gave when he was receiving an award.
It's like 25 pages long.
Yeah, it's relatively short. I think we've published it up at 1517 at least once, kind of in total with a little bit of commentary. I think I wrote some commentary, and I think so did Sam Schulteis. But it's such an interesting little work, because what he does in there is he lays out sort of the reality of a couple of things. And first is sort of the idea that he's such a fan of myth because every myth has some things in common that he thinks are precursors or shadows of what he will call the true myth, which is that Christ, you know, was incarnate for you, that he lived the perfect life for you, that he died an atoning death for you, and that he rose as third day in victory as the first fruits of your resurrection. That this thing that is, you know, a myth is not just a myth, it's the myth, and it's not just the myth, it's the true myth. But one of the reasons that we sort of have myth and have sort of commonalities within our myth of heroes that come in from the outside to kind of beat back the thistles and the thorns with their sword to release an entire kingdom that's held bondage and to kiss the princess and to save really the world, that these stories are so common because they're reflecting in us the truth of what is eventually the true myth. And he puts some names to it. He says that every good myth has a turning point that he called a eucatastrophe, which is combining just the Greek word for good and the English word catastrophe to say that, and this good catastrophe is the unexpected turn in the story. You know, just at the point where you thought all hope was lost, this outside hero comes in and turns the story to where the main protagonists go from hopeless to, you know, to actually having hope and chance and survival and deliverance.
It's the point in the story where there's an intervention or a change from the way our world operates on a daily level.
Yeah.
Right. It's that up until that point of the story, the world is recognizable in a one-to-one with your life. Ups and downs, good chapters and bad chapters, suffering and perseverance. But ultimately, when those things combine, without this eucatastrophe, the suffering will eventually win, right?
That's right.
A person can only suffer so long or in such specific ways before, without intervention, without outside intervention, without an intervention that this world does not naturally possess, things are not going to turn around.
That's right.
No, it's certainly interesting. Did you guys... have you guys ever, so you guys know of George Martin, right? Author of what's that called? Game of Thrones. You guys know?
I did watch Game of Thrones.
I know nothing about it. My wife wouldn't let me watch it either.
Why is that, Adam?
Actually, good for you, Adam. I didn't watch it either. But Martin is an interesting figure, right? Because I think a lot of the secular Tolkien fans are drawn to Martin's work because of the grandiose, large sort of fantasy world that he's built that is full of battle and strife and conquest and magic and, you know, it is a fantasy world, and it's a newer fantasy world that's got a large set of books and now a TV show, so of course there's overlap audiences. But he's, when interviewed, and I think he's written this somewhere as well, he actually says that the Game of Thrones project for him was in part an attempt to correct, in his words, Professor Tolkien, that he believes Tolkien is wrong about Eucatastrophe, about myth, about the good guy winning, and that he's got, in a sense, something we've advocated for in the show before, a low anthropology. Martin says, you know, the world isn't clean. There aren't good rulers like Aragorn who will rule after the war is over, will rule peaceably for 500 years or however it's described in the books, but that the kings don't rule with peace for 500 years, that they have tax policies that affect people in different classes differently, and they have soldiers that continue to wage wars in order to keep the peace, and they have betrayal, and they have execution, and they have, you know, the exercising of just and unjust laws, and it's not black and white. And we would say, I think that the low anthropology, the identification of as the world is fundamentally broken, is a good starting point. But what he ultimately says is that it's the way Tolkien ends story that's wrong, that it ends with hope, that it ends with the good guys actually conquering, is not representative of life in this world, and thus it is ultimately false.
Well, that's interesting, because I don't think that Tolkien is ever making an argument that you will find Aragorn in the sinful world. If that makes any sense, myth or fairy stories prefigures an event that you're going to find in a one-to-one example for here, with a president that rules for 500 years and has a tax policy that everybody is amenable to. I mean, I don't even think that's close to his argument.
And also, who would want to read the book that describes tax policy?
He's really saying that these myths, right, or these fairy stories exist, and that they exist, I'd say, one, because you're truthfully not finding this in the world, and two, you know that this is somewhere, and that's why these fairy stories prefigure the story of your redemption. Now, even Christ isn't sitting on a throne here on earth for 2,000 years managing our tax policy to be such that we all are agreeable to it, right? That's not the role that he came to play. He came to be the King of Kings, and says that he will come again in glory to judge both the quick and the dead, and that those who are his will enter into his kingdom, will there find everlasting blessedness. That's different than saying, I will come to this earth and I will create a political order for you that is agreeable to the entire world. The eucatastrophe that is Christ is everlasting and immortal. It's not a eucatastrophe of peace on this earth. It's peace on earth, right? That means a hope and a peace for mankind. And that we have stories that look like that. They're not exactly that either. He's never arguing that they're one-to-one. This was his big argument with Lewis. He's never arguing that they're one-to-one. If you were to sort of put words in his mouth that use sort of the modern vernacular, you might say that these stories touch something deep in our psyche that is recognizable to us, but it's not recognizable to us because we've experienced an Aragon here on Earth.
I think in a lot of ways, it's not only trying to play with your existing imagination of those things, but to help craft it. You know, the thing, like you've said, you have a hard time imagining certain things when you read, but TV and movies help shape that. You know, the way our imaginations work is that they, you know, they might be far off, they might be creative, they might be something like this, but something about those concepts is tangibly found in this world. Even, you know, sort of crazy creatures and things like this in myth. You know, like a griffin is two existing animals combined. There's a concrete thing of comparison or a thing it represents in the world when you're imagining something. You know, when my kids in the living room pretend to jump from one section of the couch to the other because the floor is lava, they have some idea of what lava is, what the consequences are, and why they would do this, right? Tolkien, I think... Really,
I used to love when you guys were playing lava, just like knocking you off whatever you're standing on.
just send your kids flying into the fire.
Into the lava.
Did he hit his head a lot?
No, but Emerson does.
Emerson does. Oh, my goodness gracious. That kid hits his head every day, but so does his mother, so to be fair.
I was going to make a Caleb joke there, though, about him hitting his head and why he is the way he is now.
Yeah. No, I was exceedingly careful. But
Captain Conscientious over here.
The thing is that Tolkien's stories are actually meant to help give your imagination something to cling to, and the eucatastrophe in myths give your imagination something to cling to when they hear the great story. They help concrete it. They help give you a frame of reference for what a eucatastrophe might accomplish in terms that you understand. Like,
right, so if you, and this is why, I mean, you're getting to the argument I made in Being Dad, but... where you can encounter people in this world that provide you catastrophes for you, right? The unexpected gracious churns in your life that you remember forever and ever. And then you read these stories and you're like, oh my gosh, that's great. And then you read the gospel and you're like, I wonder if that could ever be true. And you have a couple of like touch points in there beyond just the truth of the text of the scripture, but you have the touch point in there of, oh, I've heard this too in a myth. And oh, I've experienced this at least partially in a way that a person has treated me. Maybe this is true type thing. I mean, there's definite apologetic possibilities here. I mean, it's what, Montgomery's little edited volume, Myth, Allegory, and Gospel kind of gets into. And I think he calls it apologetics for the tender-hearted.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Adam, you going to say something?
Well, I was reading an essay just this morning, actually, on this, and the author called it, I think it was pre-apologetics, you know, sort of opening up the world in a way, or getting you to see past the very reductionist world you've kind of created for yourself, or your culture has told you what is the case, so that that the gospel might actually be true. Whereas in a materialist environment, you know, Tolkien and Lewis are living amidst modernists, and in many ways, they're kind of pre-modern. They want to go back to with Tolkien especially, they want to go back to the old days of
pagan myth and the materialism of their time.
And so the stories are there to just open up your mind, to get past the guards, the dragons that are guarding your mind from really seeing reality for what it is.
I was opened up to the idea that, you know, imagination is actually something developed, shaped, and cultivated, not something sort of innate or genetic in you, right? And I started noticing, and actually this led me to reading some Tolkien again, but with my kids, because I started noticing that my kids could only imagine things that they had seen on TV. If you described something, they would make analogies to something they've seen on TV. Now, I would argue my dad probably watched too much TV as a kid. Now, there might be practical reasons for that. And I watched a lot of TV, but I think I was probably saved by my mother's constant reading as far as imagination. But they were encountering this problem, right, where if you describe something, they would say, well, is that like this? And surely enough, their examples came from a TV show. Every single time. So I decided that, you know, nighttime TV would be done for a little bit, not arbitrarily permanent, but at least put on pause. And we would read their attention spans at 4 and 5 were stretched to about 20 to 30 pages out of The Hobbit a night for a while.
Wow. It's still that long.
Yeah. The first night was hard, right? Had to do it in chunks. But as we kept doing it, they would sit for longer and longer, and I could get through more pages of the book at a time. And what's amazing is that they didn't have categories from TV for some of the things described in the book, right? And there were no pictures in the book either. It wasn't like a children's book, right? And so you had to use words for nights and nights on end to try to finally get them to draw characters and shapes. What does a dwarf look like? The description of a dwarf and a hobbit, for instance, are similar but different enough that you have to start drawing those distinctions.
Yeah, you have to at least in your head kind of be able to imagine the difference.
Imagine the difference. And so, Tolkien is where I went for that when I started seeing that problem in my kids. And I wanted them to develop an ability to imagine without the television. Now, the thing is, for imagining, you still have to have something concrete, an idea. And I think Tolkien's work is worthy enough to be that concrete idea in a lot of ways where imagination can be tethered in particular ways. And Eucatastrophe is about tethering the imagination to something, to the idea of a sacrifice or this...
To the real Christ.
Yeah, to the real Christ.
Scott, you mentioned something a bit ago about the tension between Lewis and Tolkien and Lewis's overt gospel presentation, if you will, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe especially, but elsewhere, and Tolkien's subtle approach. Yeah. Why do you think that is? I mean, there was tension between them, and sometimes it wasn't just professional, right? It was more than that, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a difference between sort of Tolkien's Aquinian Roman Catholic sort of approach to analogia entis type stuff, analogies of being, and Lewis is more evangelical, straightforward approach.
Like, yeah.
why present a veiled picture when you can actually just give them Christ?
Yeah. I actually do think it is a literary difference between Thomism and evangelical theology.
Yeah. I've been thinking that lately myself, because I mean, it's almost like Lewis is urgent. There's a sense of urgency. We got to get this out there. And I mean, what does he say? Is it in Weight of Glory or somewhere where he says he talks about the other person, the people around you, your neighbors and others, that they're immortal.
Yeah.
And their destiny is not just the dirt, the long dirt nap where the worms crawl in, the worms crawl out, and they play pinochle in your snout, but rather it's beyond. It's either heaven or hell. And so Lewis is very evangelical. I think, Caleb, you said it, very evangelical, and Tolkien being very historic, traditional Catholic, where the gospel is subtle and it's one piece of a much larger picture, which includes a whole lot of emphasis on virtue and if you will, right living and
ultimately
tradition.
And proclamation belongs to the office of priest and not to people like him.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting.
Oh, is that?
And so the way he could demonstrate the gospel is by analogy or by living his life, maybe personal conversations about Christ, like he had with Lewis.
But he didn't think he had any vocational business being overt with the gospel. Is that what you're saying?
I believe that's accurate.
Wow. That's interesting. I know some other folks who aren't Catholic who are kind of like that too, but we won't say more.
Yeah. I'd be interesting to look at some, people have done work on it. I've never read any of it, but there has been some work done on sort of Tolkien's Thomism. And if you think about the Lord of the Rings, like it's complexity, you know, it's, if you're going to get Christianity out of it, you're going to have to do it by way of analogies and imagining, and even putting together sort of complex pictures and themes, whereas you just don't have to do that in Lewis.
Yeah. I told you about the reaction of our 3-year-old foster son to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Did I say that or on there or anything? We watched it. You know, he can't sit for that long, and so we watched it a couple weeks ago, and he saw Aslan being sacrificed, and he started getting teary-eyed. And he's been going to church for maybe 2-3 months, however long he's been with us. And he's like, why are they doing that to Aslan? And they're doing that to Aslan like they did something, like they killed Jesus or something. And his eyes were getting all teary-eyed. I'm getting all teary-eyed. I'm like, this is absolutely incredible. I mean, yeah. I've always believed it, like intellectually, that the analogy is profound and so obvious. But even to a 3-year-old who's been to church for maybe six Sundays, it's so obvious.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah, I think Tolkien is like, and again, there is an extent where this is why some people can, you know, get away with being massive fans, you know, again, shape their lives by the Lord of the Rings and not engage with Christianity at all. There is something to that. At some level, it's a little it is dishonest. We could call it dishonest, but also Tolkien also helps us find the limits of natural theology in a sense, and this theology by analogy, because it doesn't terminate in the proclamation.
That's right.
And so it's valuable. Like I said, I think it's valuable from helping concrete the imagination. I think
it might even be valuable in the same way that Adam just brought up, as a pre-apologetic.
Right.
But it's not. It's like arguing from creation order stuff. You know, there's a lot of work to do to get to Christ still.
Yeah.
Even if you've sort of done this pre-apologetic, or even if you sort of primed the pump of people's interest with the Lord of the Rings, you still got there's still a lot to be covered.
Well, it's like somebody just showed me
to Christ. Whereas in Lewis, like you just said, with watching The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's literally telling the whole redemption story in a single novel.
It's somebody just showed me a picture today from like a bad children's Christian book that was like, Jesus loves me, this I know, because the whole world tells me so. And it was a family staring out at the stars. And you're like, this is where natural theology has gone too far, right? You don't know the limits of the fact that the stars might be able to tell you there's a creator out there. You might even be able to determine in some ways that the creator is good and loves beauty or something like this, but you do not know who he is. You do not know that he died for you, and you certainly don't know that creator loves you.
Yeah. Very little about the creator from this observation.
Yeah.
At best, he's a designer.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's another ways where like analogy and parable can operate alongside Christian theology where they don't meet the limits of natural theology. So for instance, like, you know, Aragorn being the return of the king, right? He is the king returned, and he's going to rule with peace and prosperity as the promised king. You know, well, a Christian can hope in the return of the king. Right, of the king, Christ. Now, is Aragorn always Christ in Tolkien's books? No. But is the concept of that great king who is going to return in this turn to rule, is it something that you can latch onto and use as you envision Christ's return? Absolutely.
Yeah, and again, for me, it's always been a look at this. This stuff is reflected in story because of the truth of the main story. It's not typically the other way around.
Right. Yep. Well, guys, anything else important before we go? I mean, this is our sort of first episode on the topic besides some of what we talked about on the Inklings episode. But I thought, it, you know, this was a pretty good opportunity to discuss.
Yeah, he's definitely a lesser read character for me. I haven't, the Lord of the Rings books aren't ones that I go back to time and time again. Like, I've even read, like, the Space Trilogy several times, which usually after people read that, they're kind of out for the rest of their life. But
I've never read that. I did order it, though, so that I can read it. But I did read that Lewis thought Perelandro is his best book.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I think it probably is.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
That's the last of the three, right?
It's the middle.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've read The Lord of the Rings twice. I've reread The Hobbit more than twice. And now I'm reading it with my kids. And I really do think there's a level of new complexity that comes to the grand saga in The Lord of the Rings that doesn't exist in The Hobbit, where The Hobbit is, it is for children, and that doesn't mean it's bad writing, right? It's not like a children's book, but in a sense, things are sort of simple enough and magical enough in that story to be something I think you could read time and time again. And again, though, it is not like the Chronicles of Narnia. There is no atonement sacrifice, that's so clear in that. But it is like
there is struggle, and there is sort of quest. And there is kind of
vocation
and living life among other fallen people.
I love being drawn on your mission by somebody on the outside. This is one of the things that, like, Gandalf always does, is that it's not always a power within you that causes you to do the right thing. Sometimes it takes a wizard to come and force you along. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some interesting stuff there. But again, it was one of those ones where I was like, if I want my children to have, like, a creative, concrete imagination that they interact with the world with, this is a great place. This is a great place to read.
I have a friend who has Middle Earth tattooed wrapped around his leg. And I think he told me that just like there are these Civil War reenactors and Renaissance fair people, I won't make any judgments there, but there are people who dress up and celebrate Middle Earth and all its characters. Have you ever been to anything like that, Caleb?
They go LARPing.
Yeah. No, I've never been in it.
That's a real thing, LARPing?
Yeah, LARPing.
Live action role playing.
Oh, yeah, sorry. You're outside my wheelhouse now.
No, but I mean, lots of things like in the fantasy genre, like TV, video games, movies, you name it, even if they're not the Lord of the Rings, they will say that, like, the Lord of the Rings was foundational in. Huh. Their building of those worlds. A lot of people, I would say for fantasy today, it is the source text that people return to as their citation and the starting place for how do I build the world. And that gets to something, I mean, we're a little over time now, but that gets to something we didn't even get to hit to, which was just his linguistic mastery. He invented languages.
That's incredible.
Why is Tolkien's world the foundation for fantasy world in modern fiction today? It's because he was the one who could actually write language and build landscape and have a coherent map. And
he was a serious scholar.
And tie that together. And now other people can take that and use it for their own creative endeavors.
Interesting.
So, very, very interesting figure, you know, foundational member of the Inklings, amazingly important in Lewis's conversion in life as well.
Yeah, so we didn't talk about that. We don't have time to talk about it, but he wasn't the only one, but integral in convincing Lewis that Christianity is the true myth.
And the most orthodox of the people preaching that to him.
That's right. Always disappointed in Lewis for not coming all the way to Roman Catholicism.
But kind of glad that he stayed in evangelical, personally.
Yeah, me too.
So, well, great, guys. It was a fun discussion. I hope this is satisfying for listeners who have been asking us for probably years now to at least do something on Tolkien. I greatly enjoy his fiction, and I do think it's important to interact with his theology of myth as well. So, very good, guys. Well, thank you for joining us on this episode. If you would like to support the Thinking Fellows and 1517 Podcast Network, you can go to 1517.com. CSLewisMovie.org/donate. A big thank you to everybody who helped us reach our Giving Tuesday goal of $200,000 last week. We did meet that goal. Unlike, you know, not only did we have a bigger goal than we had last year, we met the goal like 3 hours earlier than last year as well. So we are thankful for everybody who pitched in and helped. If you would like to find out more ways that you can help 1517 or maybe commit to supporting the podcast network earlier in 2022, you can reach out via our website. There's a contact form, or you can sign up for a reoccurring donation today on the website. We appreciate your listenership and your support. We will catch you next week. Bye.